We'll start with questions from yesterday, and then I'll do a brief recap, and then we continue. Yes.
I'm Hyo Jung, and my question is, when you talked about Noether's theorem yesterday, I was wondering what's the R sub S in the formula? Yeah.
Okay. Today we'll see an explicit example, so I will come back to that in a bit. Yeah.
Also, where does the S lead?
Okay, so the... Okay, what was your name, sorry?
My name is Zura, Z-U-R-A.
Zura, okay. I'll keep it in mind for the recap as well. And any more? Yeah?
I had a specific question. Yes. It was, so you know how we had delta gamma?
Yeah.
So that's the sort of variation of the trajectory. Where does that live? Is it in the tangent space or is it in the space?
So since it's an infinitesimal change, it is in the tangent space to the space of histories.
Right.
So but we're not
by epsilon, which has to give you something in the space.
Well, it's more that I'm using so I'm working in coordinates. So if I work in coordinates, I'm effectively describing whatever manifold I'm dealing with in a linear I'm mapping it to Rn, so now I have a linear space. So it doesn't really matter if it lives in the space, in the tangent space or whatever. If I want to do things truly geometrically, then I would have to introduce an infinite dimensional space of histories with vector fields on top of it and so on and so forth. So it would become much more heavy to formalize. And we will do that in the quantum gravity course. So if you're into that kind of stuff, you just have to wait a few months.
Can we consider delta gamma just like as a history and like epsilon with dimensionless parameters that controls it?
No, because the sum of two is, so if I work in a linear space, so particles in Rn, I can add so for example, let's do it like this. So suppose I have a history, which is x of t.
Absolutely.
And these are Cartesian coordinates. And then I add to these some variation, which doesn't matter whether it's big or small, and I call it, I don't know.
Say it lives. Okay.
Let's say I add eta of t. This is fine. This is a new history, and then I can take this one to be small, and everything would be okay. But now, suppose I'm on, and it doesn't matter how big this is. So I can think of these as another element of the same space. And since the space is linear, I can add them and find another element of that space.
Yeah.
However, if I'm on a sphere and I'm working in r theta phi coordinates, for example, or simply I'm working on the same space but in spherical coordinates, I can't say r prime of t is equal to r theta phi of t plus an arbitrary element here. Because this, for example, has to say between 0 and 2 and pi, right? So this is between 0 and pi. This must be positive and infinity. And this is between 0 and 2 pi. So if these elements are arbitrary, they could take me off of these domains. And the point is that these are not linear coordinates. I might even have spaces which are not linear, so the surface of a sphere. So I cannot freely add things. But as long as these elements are small, so that's why I multiply them by epsilon, then this problem that doesn't arise.
Yeah. And that's what I was saying. So we can, so delta gamma we can consider as a history, and epsilon as a control parameter, as a number.
But that's the question PA, right? Yeah. Was asking, which is, in which space does this live? This is not really a history. This is the tangent space of histories. It's essentially the space of arrows on top of your space of histories. It's a small variation in the history. But you will do this. You will introduce this geometrical language in the next block for GR.
Yeah. application.
Right now, it's a bit of an overkill to try to make it very precise. I understand that it's tempting to want to make things precise, but I would have to introduce too many things to be able to do it. Then.
Yeah.
And those of you who know it would find it boring, and those of you who don't might be lost because they have to go too fast. So it's not really useful, but if you're really into this, you can come to my office. I'm happy. I just don't want to do it in the class. Yeah. But the idea is that if these are small and I'm working in coordinates, I can add a small variation in the coordinate and I will stay in my space and there is no problem. That's why I'm being a bit fudgy.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this kind of only works because we are in some kind of affine space, right? That we have like points and we add vectors to them, but if we're not in an affine space.
No, it's more that I'm working in coordinates. So I'm in a chart. In a chart, I can always, since they're open sets, I can always add small changes. Once I describe them in coordinates, I'm mapping this open set of the manifold onto Rn. Rn is linear, and then I can do that. Okay, so this was a bit of an aside for geometers. Okay, so I review another theorem. I start from there, and so I can address the question about Rs, and
S.
Yes. So, well, S, the question is the same as here. So S is in the tangent space, but we just think of it as this small variation that I'm adding. So I will dodge the question about S because it's very similar to this one that I just answered.
Okay,
so for another, let's say we have a history. So today I will call histories Q of t, not use gamma unless is necessary, so that I make the notation a bit lighter. So I have my history Q of t, and I vary it a little bit by introducing a new history, which I will call Q prime equal Q of t, my old one, plus some small variation. So here is how this works. I have Q, I have t, I have my original history Q of t, and I'm adding some small variation around it, like that. So this is epsilon delta Q. And this object, I allow it to depend on Q of t, but also Q dot of t. And in fact, and t. So this is what your function S is. This is, in yesterday's lecture, we call them, this is S of Q, V, and T. So this is what S was, except that I was working on the tangent space instead of on histories. But then once we have a history, I can replace Q and V by Q, T, and Q dot of T, and so obtain a change in a small variation in the space of histories. Okay, but the main formula is this one, and I have to remember that this object can depend on those quantities. Next, once we have this, we can look at what happens to our Lagrangian, and we then can evaluate our Lagrangian over Q dot and T over the new history. And an important fact is that since Q prime is just d over dt of these so the velocity of the new history is just the time derivative of whatever I had there, what happens is that this is the old velocity plus the time derivative of the variation. So in this way, there's no mystery about what this the variation of the velocity is, and I just call it, for short, q dot, delta q dot. But what I really have in mind is this time derivative. So this is what this is. And now what I'm asking is that delta q is an infinitesimal symmetry. Symmetry if and only if this happens. So this is the old Lagrangian. Plus a term in epsilon, which however I ask to be a total derivative in t. So whatever this is, this can depend on q dot, and more. And everything else should be higher order. So what I'm asking is I can write this more evocatively as saying that the variation of the Lagrangian is a total derivative in time. So this is a total derivative. This is very important. It's not the partial derivative of R with respect to time. Is I have to vary all its element, all its entries. So now we will see an example where this actually arises. Noether theorem then says if delta q is an infinitesimal symmetry, then the quantity q of t defined as delta qi minus rs is conserved on shell of the equations of motion. Okay, so on shell, what does it mean? It means that to find zero on the right hand side of dt of qs equals zero, here I have to use the equations of motion. So if whatever those are, so but it means that for any physical realization of my system, this quantity will not depend on time. Okay, so one last comment before going into giving explicit examples of this theorem is that this object here, we will often call it, we will call it PI. And it's called the generalized momentum. Okay. So this is just a name, as usual, which you already know from Hamiltonian mechanics. Okay. We briefly saw that this theorem encompasses the case where we have a cyclical variable and the corresponding momentum is conserved. So let's do that again more slowly, and then we move on to more interesting examples. Example one, cyclical variable. So let's say Q1 cyclical if and only if dl over dq1 is zero. So L does not depend on my variable q1. And we saw that from the equations of motion, we found that it's immediate to find that P1 Oops. P1 is conserved. Because I write my, let me write, do it here. I write my Euler-Lagrange equation for Q1. These are zero, and therefore this is the same as saying zero minus d over dt of pi 1 by definition, p1, sorry, is equal to zero. So of course this is working. But now we want to find this result as a consequence of the theorem. So where do I have to start from? I have to start from by telling you what is my delta tilde. So choose delta tilde of q I to be 1 if I is 1 and 0 otherwise. So I'm only changing q1, which is in line with the fact that I know what happens to q1 and that L is invariant under changes of q1. So this is the idea here. From this, it immediately follows that delta q I dot is always zero, because here nothing happens, and here I'm deriving 1 in time, so I get zero. Now I need to check that I satisfy the hypothesis of the theorem, that is that delta L is a total derivative in time. We will find that it is zero, so it's even simpler. So we do delta L. This will be the sum over I of dl over dqi delta qi plus dl over dq dot I delta q dot I. Of course, we find that this one is zero. We just computed this fact. And second, we find that this is zero for most of them. Zero. So this is a delta in I and zero. So it means that either I is equal to zero, sorry, to one, or it vanishes. And therefore, this becomes delta L of dq1. But because of the cyclicity hypothesis, this is zero. So we find that delta q is an infinitesimal symmetry. Infinitesimal symmetry for RS equals zero. I don't have to put any RS in this case, because there's zero on the right-hand side of this quantity. And therefore, what I find is that QS equal sum over I of PI delta QI minus RS is actually just equal to pi 1 is conserved. What is the advantage? So I found the previous result. Like this, it seems completely boring and uninteresting. But what is the interest in this generalization? The interest is that to see that a variable is cyclical, I need to use the right coordinates. Otherwise, I may not see it. For example, if I have a system that is invariant under translations along the x-axis, if I write things in terms of x, y, and z, then I just look at my Lagrangian and see that it does not depend on x. But if I go and write things in spherical coordinates, in theta, phi, and r, translations along x look like nothing. They're not easy to see. The Lagrangian will depend on all the variables. It will be hard to detect a priori. And so I don't have any cyclical variable in this case. But still, if I'm smart enough, I might be able to cook up the right variation, and then the theorem guarantees that I have a conservation in that case too. So the problem with the cyclical variable formulation, the first problem, is that it's a coordinate dependent statement, essentially. It depends on which coordinates you're using to describe your system. Whereas Noether theorem doesn't care about the coordinates that you're choosing to describe your system. It's written in coordinates, but in fact, it doesn't. You can prove that if you change coordinates, Q will not care. Okay. So this is the first thing. The second thing we will see later when we talk about angular momentum, why the cyclical, what can also happen is that there are more conserved quantity than you can write in one go as coming from the cyclicity of a variable. So for example, again, if you have rotational invariant now, if it is rotation around the z-axis, I can use cylindrical coordinate, and if things are invariant, my Lagrangian will not depend on phi, the polar angle, and then I find that the angular momentum is conserved. This is one exercise you will get to do. But now, if I have complete invariance under rotations, I can choose more. I can choose a phi angle for about one axis, but I can't find three angles about the three axis. There's no coordinate system like that. So in that case, I cannot write all the three components of the angular momentum to be conserved as a consequence of the cyclicity with respect to an angular variable. That cannot be done. And there is a good reason why it cannot be done, and we will see it in a moment after the first example. Let's do it. Let's do this example first. Yes.
What is RS, I mean, except for being the variation of Lagrangian? I mean, the physical concept.
No, it doesn't really have a... It doesn't have a physical reality of its own. The thing that has a physical meaning is Q, which is built by that combination. Okay. So for example, so this is something I should have mentioned. This is an excellent question because, this is an important fact that I forgot to mention yesterday. So if I have a Lagrangian like this, and I replace it by a new Lagrangian, which is the old one, plus the total time derivative of something that depends only on Q and T, my action principle will not be altered. Why? Because I'm just adding a boundary term to the action, and at the boundary, I'm keeping Q fixed. Right? So this will not change absolutely anything to the description of the system. So these are equivalent Lagrangians. C action principle. With delta Q at T0 and T1 equals 0. Now, what happens if I do my Noether theorem for the Lagrangian L and L prime? So it's clear that delta Q is a symmetry of L, then it is a symmetry. Well, I could say delta Q is a symmetry of L if and only if delta Q is a symmetry of L prime, right? However, what is happening is that L changes and RS changes, but Q doesn't. So this is showing that, first of all, that term is necessary for things to make physical sense, because what is truly invariant is not so much L itself, is L up to these additions. And so you need a formulation of the theorem that is invariant under these changes. So that's one thing. But there are cases in which it's really necessary to add it to get the right charge. That is, there is no choice of little L for which it goes away. And we will see one in a second. And you actually already know it, just might not have seen it in this form. Okay, so let's do rotations as an example. So let's take L equal let me do it for a particle in a central potential. Particle in central potential. So this is x dot square minus v of x. Right? So this is a way to write the Lagrangian. So it's the kinetical energy minus the potential energy, and the potential energy only depends on the radius. Now, I do a change of coordinates. And I say that x is equal to r cos theta, y is equal r sin theta, and z equal to sin theta, cos phi, cos phi. Okay, now it's better. And I compute x dot, y dot, and z dot, and so on, and I replace it, and what I find is 1/2 m r dot square plus r square theta square plus r square sine square theta phi dot square minus v of r. So here, so I have a system which is completely invariant under all three rotations. However, it sounds like the best choice of coordinates to describe the system is spherical coordinates. It should make all the symmetries manifest. In fact, it doesn't. Because as we see, these we have that dl over d phi is 0. So we know that p of phi will be conserved. Is conserved. And p of phi, this is a small exercise I want you to do in full generality, so I will not do it here. Turns out to be equal to the z component of the angular momentum. Just a second.
Sorry, just to double check. That's supposed to be r cos theta, right? Z is equal to r cos theta?
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So p phi is conserved and is the z component of the angular momentum. We know that the full angular momentum is conserved, but I cannot see it as a bunch of symmetries associated to three cyclical variables. And the reason why this is not possible is quite deep, and is due to the following fact. Cyclicity of a variable means that I get invariance under translations of that variable, which is this one. And translations commute with each other. It means that I can do first a translation along my variable q1, then q2, or q2 and q1, and nothing changes. However, we know that a rotation around one axis does not commute with a rotation around another axis. No matter how hard I try, I will never find a set of coordinates for which two or three of the components of the angular momentum emerge as momenta of a cyclical variable. At most, one of them can. So this is another reason why Noether theorem is important, because it doesn't care about this. It just gives you all the charges at once. I can write the most general rotation. In fact, it's not too hard. I can do it I can say that x prime is x plus what is an infinitesimal rotation. It means that I'm taking some vector a and multiplying it by x. So these will maybe it's not super obvious, but suppose I have a, this is a rotation around the axis A. So if I have a vector and I take the cross product, this will be a vector which is at the same time orthogonal to A and the vector, so lies in this plane, and so it's a rotation of this vector about that axis. If it makes, it's a bit hard to draw, but it is the right thing. So if I replace, if I call this my delta x, it's immediate to see that L is invariant, because this clearly doesn't, it takes a couple of steps, but this is clearly invariant under rotation, so I don't have to worry, and these two from the way I wrote it. So the only thing I have to do is to compute Q, and let's compute Q for this variation. Is the sum of dl over d xi dot delta q. So this is a cross xi minus 0. In this case, rs will be 0. It's a simple exercise. I'm not going to prove it here. So what is this? Well, this is precisely pi. So this is, in fact, p dot a cross x. Rearranging, this is a dot angular momentum. So the angular momentum, the direction a, and since a, in fact, doesn't really matter which a I choose, I find the conservation of all the components of the angular momentum. So this is how the Noether theorem generalizes in the case of rotation, the conservation of the moment.
Yeah. And when you mentioned that like just the clear coordinates is not enough because with phi and theta we cannot express a.
No, you can always translate this kind of transformation in terms of theta, phi, and r will be extremely complicated and of little interest, but you can find it. It's just that what I wanted to emphasize is that although rotation around an axis can be made into an explicit symmetry in the sense that L will not depend on the polar coordinate phi, there's no way to put the three rotation in that form at once. So of course, here it's quite arbitrary what I'm calling z. So it's obvious that if it's true for one set of spherical coordinate, it will be true for all of them. So any component of this vector is conserved. But I'm implicitly using the fact that this is rotationally invariant to make this statement. So I already know the answer. But these are simple situations which are under control because we have intuition about them. But it's just to say that in general, there are symmetries that to fully capture them, you can't just rely on the cyclicity of a variable. You need something more general and more powerful. A simple example of, here we saw, let's see. Let's do time translation symmetry then, which is, in a way, the most interesting example. Any question before we move on to time translations? So let's consider a history Q prime of T, which is my original history translated by some time T, big T. This is same history, but translated in time. So notice here, I'm not saying that I'm changing the time parameter. I'm saying that I'm changing the history. Okay. So the picture is the following. I have some history Q of T. And the new one will be something like this. Oops. You get the idea. So, and this red one is Q prime of T. So I'm just translating this by an amount T. But these are two different histories if I look at them in this graph. It's not the same. And now I'm asking, is the receive, if, so the claim, time translation is a symmetry if the Lagrangian does not depend explicitly on time. So we want to prove this. What is the conserved quantity if the Lagrangian does not depend on time? You know?
Energy.
It's the energy. So we will find the energy at the end. Okay. So first of all, we need to find our delta. So in this case, what I have to do is to have an infinitesimal parameter epsilon here. And so this becomes Q of T plus epsilon T Q dot. So here, in this case, delta, well, I just put epsilon. There's no really a good reason to keep the T. So delta Q I, in this case, will be Q dot. So this symmetry is already different from those that we've seen before, because I'm thinking of a change of my configuration, which depends on the velocity. So this is quite different than what we were seeing before, where we were rotating coordinates or things like this. So this sometimes, when this happens, some people call this a hidden symmetry, because it depends also on the velocity. It cannot be detected only by looking at configuration space. So in a sense, it's more hidden. But so. So change of configuration depends on instantaneous velocity. So this is what is special here. So now if I compute delta tilde q I, so this is what? This is d over dt of delta q, and this is q dot dot. Okay. Next, I have to check the invariance of the Lagrangian. Well, let's compute delta l. This is the sum over I of dl over dq delta q plus dl over dq dot delta q dot. This is what? This is sum over I of dl over dq q dot plus dl over dq dot q dot dot. What is this? This is, I claim, d over dt of L minus the partial derivative. What? Yeah?
In the previous line, how did you know to apply the time derivative operator after applying the delta tilde operator?
No, no. This is my definition over here. I look at the new velocity. And that's just what it is. I'm just using this weird symbol with delta q dot, but it's not the delta of q dot. It's just the what I'm calling that.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so now we have this. Why this is true? Because when I do the total time derivative, what I have to do is to apply the chain rule. I have to derive in time all the variables by which L depends. On which L depends. So I have to derive by Q and multiply by Q dot. I have to derive by Q dot and multiply by Q dot dot. I have to derive by T. Here that does not appear. That's why I'm taking it away. So this is just an identity that is the definition of what this means. OK, now if this is 0, therefore, if dt of L is equal to 0.
Should we want both in the second term, the partial here, right?
Yeah, here, yes. It was an I that became a dot. Okay. Delta tilde of Q is a symmetry, an infinitesimal symmetry, with, and now RS is not 0. We found the total time derivative here with RS equal L. And with this, we are done. So I'll go up here because it takes just a line. We compute QS is the sum of PI delta QI minus RS. And this is the sum over I of pi qi dot minus L, which is the energy. So this is an important case where RS, in fact, is the only case that will appear in this course in which RS is non-trivial. Except when we'll do field theory, then there will be more general cases. But in mechanics, this is the only one. So when I'm looking at a translation in time, which is this parameter on which the histories depend. So it's not a variation of the configuration space. It's the variation of the support, in a sense, but which I'm reinterpreted as a variation of the history, as a time translation of the history. In that case, RS appears. So. But it's crucial to get the right quantity. Otherwise, again, this does not depend on which Lagrangian I'm choosing because of this. So if I translate my Lagrangian by total derivative of that depends only on Q, this everything will be fine. Okay. So this is the generalized energy. So it could be an exercise to check explicitly that this is conserved. But we can, if you want to do it, to just make sure that you understand exactly what is going on, you can derive this by t and use the equation of motion to prove that this is. I think this covers the. So now I will change topic. So if you have, I leave you a couple of minutes. I drink some water, erase the blackboard, well, move the blackboards around, and you can think if you have questions, and then we'll...
rational.
So there are different formulations of Noether theorem. Some of them do not have this arrest term, but they're phrased differently. And we will see we will see this formulation in the tutorial. So I find these a bit more useful because it generalizes nicely to field theory in a way that I will use in the course in April. But in the end, is maybe the other one is a bit more standard. So they're equivalent in the end. So the difference is that here I'm looking just at changes in the histories. I'm not considering changes in the time parameter as part of the symmetry. In that case, things will be written differently. You allow for an explicit change in the time parameter and at the same time a change in the history, and then things kind of mix up in particular ways. And it's a topic of the tutorial, but I just want to say that if you've seen the Noether theorem, you might not have seen it in this form, and the tutorial covers another one. Okay, the next topic is Hamiltonian. Well, questions? About them? The next topic is Hamiltonian mechanics. So now what we want to do, at least in principle, is to solve these Euler-Lagrange equations. So the Euler-Lagrange equations, I write them again. I write them actually in this form. So if I want to solve these equations, let's first see what kind of equations they are. They're second order equations because L can depends on Q and Q dot. So whatever this is, a priori will depend on Q and Q dot. And if I derive in time, in here, there will be terms like Q dot dot. And so these are second order differential equations. Now, how do you solve an ordinary differential equation? In principle, there is a completely mechanical way to do it, at least perturbatively. But what this requires is to recast them in a form where they are first order equations. So, naively, I can rewrite these as q dot dot I equals something, some force if you want. So these are accelerations, so there will be some generalized forces. I can write it like this. And then from here, I can write it as q dot equal v, and vi equal vi dot equal f, whatever this is. This will depend on the Lagrangian, which will depend on q and v. OK, so I've recast them in a first order formulation. And so if I double up my variables, let's say I call z. The idea is the following. I call z q and v, and then I have that z dot will be equal to uh, Let's see if I do it right. So one and V dot will be F zero Z, right? So becomes a fourth order differential equation in many components, and there are mechanical ways to solve these equations. And they have a geometrical interpretation that we will see, so I will not spend time on this case. However, the point is that here, this V does not appear clearly anywhere in this formulation. What I nicely have is dl over dq dot. So it seems like a good idea to use this quantity instead of V as a variable, because then it looks like I will have a nice fourth order differential equation in that variable. So it seems nicer to use P, which is Q dot, instead. So this is, in fact, I should write it like this, instead of V itself. Right? Because of this term here. So a way to do this is to use the Legendre transform has exactly this job, to take a function L that depends on a quantity V and give you another function that contains, in quotes, the same information as the original one, but is instead a function of its derivative. So let's go through this construction. So suppose I have a f of x is a convex function. So this is x. This is f. Okay. So what I want is to find the new function, which is instead. Okay, this is not a good drawing because I will have to, I don't have enough space. So let's do it like this. So why I wanted convex? I wanted convex because the map from P to dl over, okay, sorry. I'm going to be too fast. F convex, what I want is to find a new function g of y that encodes the same information which means that is a transformation that is reversible essentially. If I know f of x, I produce a g of y and I can go back. Where y is equal to the derivative of x. Because this is the situation we have here. L is, maybe I can call it, actually, sorry. Let me call it with the right name so we avoid changing names too many times. H of P, and P is dl over V. So this is V now. Okay, so this is the situation we have. So we are forgetting about the Qs. We're just focusing on the Vs. So for this to work, we need L to be convex because we want this to be one-to-one. Otherwise, there is a problem. If a minimum requirement to encode the same information is that for every V, there is only one P. So we want this transformation to be one-to-one. Remark, we need dl over dv to be monotonous in V to get a unique P, to get a which is 1-to-1. But this means that L is convex, because this monotonous means that the second derivative, well, it could be decreasing, of course. So here I pick the positive by convention. Otherwise, I can always take minus L, and it's fine. So I want this to be strictly positive, which means that it is convex. So this is why I want this convex. So here we have, so this is my derivative at this point. And so this will be my P, this angle, like the tangent of that angle. Here I have L of V, and here I have V. Right? So the function h of p is defined as follows. So it's defined by the following requirement. H of p is equal to p v of p minus L of v of p, where v of p is the inverse of these relations, is the inverse function of v to p equal so dv, which is invertible because we have convexity. So if you look at this equation and you write it as and you write it like this, we have v times p gives me the sum of these two quantities, right? And that's what is encoded there. So this is a way to visualize what the Legendre transform is. And it also shows, well, here not so much the picture, that is perfectly symmetric in the role of P and Vs. So if I can go one way, I can always go back. So that's the same information. The fact that they encode the same information is because I can always go back. And a way to say it mathematically is that it is an involution. So if I do it twice, I go back to the original function. Okay. If I this is called the Legendre transform of so. Doing the Legendre transform twice gives back the original function. Okay. So this is the story about the Legendre transform, and now we want to apply it to our equations of motion. Questions so far?
So in physics, we start from a Lagrangian, which is a function of Q, V, and T.
We're only doing the Legendre transform on V.
So we get something that depends on Q, on P, and on T.
So we traded V for P. And what kind of relationships we have from this story over here.
So we have that P is equal to dl over dv. But we also know that because things are perfectly symmetric, we also know that V is dh over dp,
is this involutivity over here that guarantees that. So this formula is symmetric in P and V, so it doesn't matter whom I'm doing the Legendre transform of. The next thing is why, well, I should have said it. The first thing was why L is convex. L is convex because it's very generally quadratic in V, so it will be convex. So I'm happy.
So remark L convex because quadratic in V. And finally, well, there is this observation that dl over dq, since the Legendre transform is only on V, Q is just a witness here, doesn't really matter. So if I derive h by Q, there is no Qs here, so I just get minus dh over dq. And finally, then, I look at my equations of motion. They become D. I have this structural equation over here, which is Q dot equal dH over dP. And then I have P dot, which is this one, which is minus dH over dq. So this is this. And this one is this one.
So these are the Hamilton equations of motion, and they are, by construction, fully equivalent to the original ones.
Hamilton's equations of motion, and H is called the Hamiltonian function. L was the Lagrangian function, H is the Hamiltonian function.
But if L is not generally convex, then
no. You wouldn't find the. It would be true
just where.
Yeah, piece by piece, but not globally.
But convexity we require only in kinetic term, right?
Yeah, it's only in the kinetic term. It's only in V. Yeah. So that's why it's okay, in fact. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the Hamiltonian function.
And we also see. Where is it? Here. This is pq dot minus L. So of course, it's related to the generalized energy that we saw before. Except that this is a function of q and p and not of a history like E was. So that's the difference. Remark. Let's do it here. Oops. Nope. What does this mean? Remark. H of Q and P
and t is a function on, well, so q and if q and v were parameterizing the tangent space, q and p parameterize the cotangent space. Again, we're not entering into the geometrical details, but times time. So this is q and p, and this is t. And this is called the cotangent space. Given a history,
by looking at the at the formula over there that defines what H is,
H of Q and P equal Q, sorry, PQ dot minus L of QQ dot T becomes is equal to the generalized energy.
But there is a conceptual difference between these two. One is just a function on this finite dimensional space, of so a function of P's and Q's, whereas these so to write this Q as a Q dot and not as a function of P, I'm using implicitly the fact that I know the history. So once I have the history, I can interpret this as the energy. Of course, I can also interpret H as the energy associated to Q and P. But the way we found out what the energy was associated to a history, not so much to a given.
Yeah. Would you mind giving quickly again the motivation for how you chose the form of H in the beginning, because you wanted it to encode the same information? I just kind of missed the argument.
Well, why I'm choosing this specific formula for, so naively one might want to have HP equal L of V of P. That's the naive guess. It turns out that adding this extra term, PV, actually makes things better, because is what in fact guarantees that one has this this relationship, that one can go back in that way. So that's what actually is guaranteeing that really the symmetry between the two. There is more of an heuristic argument. One would have to prove that it actually works to go back. And this PV is what is guaranteeing that it will work in the end.
So not necessarily a unique choice, it's just what gives nice answers.
Well, I don't know if there are other ways of doing this. This is the way that mathematicians have conceived, and it works, and it's used in thermodynamics, in mechanics, and so on. So, and it gives, if you were to use just if you would drop P of V of V, you wouldn't get Hamilton's equation. And in fact, probably you would have issues in inverting the transformations. I haven't tried to see. I know that way it does work.
Sorry.
Yeah.
For obtaining the Hamiltonian formalism, we had this constraint that the Lagrangian should be quadratic, in terms of V, the kinetic energy. And I think the Lagrangian formalism and the Hamiltonian formalism are somehow equivalent.
Yeah.
But, we didn't have the same constraint there. So, what about the Lagrangian that are not canonical and, it's not quadratic in terms of V? Can we still use the Lagrangian formalism and we can't use the Hamiltonian formalism with this?
Yeah, so the Lagrangian formalism is Yes, in the case you have a Lagrangian which is, I don't know, non-quadratic, then you can still use the Lagrangian formulation, because the Lagrangian formulation is just a minimization problem, and it doesn't care. You can have the weirdest possible things going on, and it would work. To be able to translate between Lagrangian and Hamiltonian you and have a full equivalence of the two, you need this convexity. So maybe it's quartic in the velocities and convex, which and then it would work as well. But it's more, in a way, it's a technical issue where you want a one-to-one correspondence between V and P. So if given a Q and V, you are to find a unique Q and P on the other side, you need convexity. That's what it's for.
So these true formalisms are only equivalent if the Lagrangian is quadratic?
Well, in general, convex, but quadratic is what usually happens. So all the Lagrangians we will look at will be quadratic in time derivatives. So that's what matters. And so quadratic doesn't mean just V square, can have a linear term as well. That's fine.
Yes.
But they're still, yes.
So to me it seems like you're making the Lagrangian like more fundamental than the Hamiltonian. So can we also like reverse it, like start with the Hamiltonian and then like?
Now I will write down an action principle for the Hamiltonian. So which one is the right one? I don't know. In all systems I know you can switch from one to the other. But what is the real one? That I don't think it's it depends what works, and I don't, and there might be cases I'm not an expert in this subtopic where one works and the other doesn't, and if there are crazy systems that can be cooked up in the lab where one works and the other, I don't know. But so the next step is to find an action principle for the Hamiltonian formula. Let's do it. So one thing I want to emphasize one last time, and this is mostly because I used to be confused about this as a student, so maybe it's not a confusion to you, and that's perfectly fine. But I was always a bit confused about, in the Lagrangian, it seems that I have Q and Q dot, and sometimes they're independent, but they're also not because one is the time derivative of the other, but in the Hamiltonian formulas, I have Q and P, and I have to treat them as independent, what's going on? So the point is, also in the Lagrangian, Q and V are independent. It's just when I'm computing the action that I'm plugging in a history and evaluating it on the history. So there is no actual difference in this regard between the Lagrangian and Hamiltonian formulas. So I hope that this longer detour into these details might have helped clarifying these type of questions. But
sorry, you said independent until you evaluate them on a history, right?
Yeah, because in the history we have that Q dot is the time derivative, well, gamma dot is the time derivative of gamma. But at any given instant, I can have Q with any V. So it's only once I have the history gamma of T that I can relate them. But if I have a snapshot, I could change the velocities and keep the configuration, there wouldn't be any problem. So one is, and when I do the initial value problem, I have to give a coordinate and their velocity at the initial time, and I can give them freely as, like, they don't need to be related to each other in any way. And I can give Q and P in the Hamiltonian formulas. That's what I have to give. And they are independent. They are indeed independent because they are at a given instant. It's just when I know the history that I can relate them.
So, for example, when you're solving that system of first order ODEs, they're independent, right?
So there, Q and V are at first independent, but then when I'm looking for a history, everything must be self-consistent. And therefore, I have these extra equations that tell me that V must be the derivative of Q. So with this comment, let's go back and try to be a bit more precise about things. So we have h, which is a function on the cotangent space and time, and gives me back a number. So this is q, p, time, gives me back h of q, p, and t. And then I have a history. I keep calling it gamma, which is a map from time into the cotangent space. So in this case, it's t, which is mapped to q and p, which are gamma q at time t and gamma p at time t. OK. Now I want to find an action, which is a function of gamma and two initial, and an initial time and a final time. And the action I want to, that I will introduce is the following. This is a bit, so let me be completely bored, like completely, it's horrible. Nobody writes it in this way, but let me do it anyway. And then I will say what is a function of. S is the integral from t0 to t1 in dt of sum of pi q dot I minus h p and t. What I want to emphasize in this horrible writing over here is that I'm using the history. But yeah, this is the way it's usually written. OK, so you see, this is essentially the original Lagrangian. So however, I'm looking at it as a function of p and q, and not as a function of q and q dot. And it's a function of p and q, but also p dot and q dot, except that p dot does not appear. That's what I'm. So this q dot is not a function of p, is really q dot, because now I have a history. That's the point I'm trying to make. Something that I haven't mentioned. Sorry about that. This t star q, physicists call it phase space. Okay, so now let's look whether this action principle is well defined. So I take delta S. This delta S will be, and if it gives me the right equations of motion. So this is a variation of the history, right? History variation.
So this will be the sum of delta pi q dot I minus, so I have to, well, let's do it slowly. Delta q dot I minus dh over dq delta q dh over dp delta p. But now this one, I want to write it as, so this is the same as d over dt of delta qi. I integrate by parts. And so I find that this is sum over dpi. Let me collect dpi. So I have q dot I minus dh over dpi plus delta qi. And here I have, I'm integrating by parts, so I get the plus. Sorry, there's something. Oh, here is a plus. Sorry. So this is a plus. So I get the minus. So I get minus pi dot minus dh over dqi. And then I have a boundary term. So this is where my, and the boundary term is p delta q. So what are, if I want to have a well-defined action principle, it turns out that I don't need to fix q and p at the boundary. So it's not that the full history is fixed at the boundary values, just the q's. Okay, so only half of the variables, and we're happy because we don't want stronger conditions than we had before. If we had to fix p's and q's, would be like fixing q and v's, and that would be too much because we need to give only like the initial conditions. If I count how many initial conditions or boundary conditions I have to give, they're just 2n and not 4n, essentially. If n is the number of indices I. And these are the Hamilton's equations of motion, of course. So in the first order action principle, fix delta q equals 0 at t0 and t1, and no conditions on p. And then the rest is the same. Then we require that delta s with this condition is equal to 0. This gives me the with delta q t0 delta q t1 equals 0. If and only if Hamilton equations. And the reason why it's called first order is because it gives me first order equations down here. It's not so much about a priori, so much about the fact that I have only first derivative appearing here is about what kind of equations I get later. Because otherwise, even the usual Lagrangian only has first derivative appearings. It's just v. So it's not about what appears in the action, it's what comes out of in the equation.
Okay.
Okay. So this, let's see if I have anything to add. And this I want to say that it is same as before, as in Lagrangian action principle. Where there are no conditions on V. We ended in time. Okay. Yeah.
I have a question. When you talked about rotations, example for Lagrangian. Mechanics, you explained the number of conserved quantities might not be the same as the number of cyclic coordinates.
Yes.
And you talked about, you said Noether's theorem is, you talked about why Noether's theorem is really important because like, rotations don't.
Yeah, it's more general. It doesn't,
yeah.
It's a generalization of the idea that the cyclic variables gives a conserved quantity. Because we saw that whenever you have it, you can apply Noether theorem and get the quantity you were expecting as a conserved quantity, but is in fact much more general.
Oh, OK.
Clarify what? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Is there a one-line proof of Noether's theorem in the notes?
A one-line proof?
Of Noether's theorem?
Do you know the answer?
In the notes, yes.
Oh, right, I didn't prove it. Sorry, okay. I should have proved the Noether theorem. But it's really a one-line proof. It's super simple. I will do it tomorrow for a start. I just ran through the examples and forgot to eventually prove it. Thanks, Jackie. I was completely oblivious. Okay.
Yeah, I think I was confused about RS until I saw the proof for the first time.
Okay, thanks. See you this afternoon.